It's difficult to find a way which just makes it transparent from the very outset. So the way it's usually presented in the textbooks is that you have some path integral that you want to gauge fix. You do the gauge fixing by hand, introducing extra factors or Jacobians in the path integral to make sure that everything is fine. And then you rewrite these Jacobians in some convenient way using some auxiliary variables, and out pops this magical symmetry which makes everything cleaner. Now, the possible opposite direction is that you start with studying these sort of symmetries, and then you find that using this kind of symmetry you can produce a gauge fixing. This has the disadvantage that the symmetry, this kind of, you just wonder why am I talking about this kind of symmetries before knowing that you can use them for gauge fixing. So anyway, there's no easy, no obvious thing to do. So I just go the second route for cleanliness. So perhaps the first analogy one can use is just a standard bosonic integral. Suppose you're integrating something over a sphere. There are, and you take a function on a sphere, you can expand it in a spherical harmonics, say. And you know that if you expand a function in spherical harmonics and then you integrate it over the sphere, the integral of the sphere will kill all the non-trivial harmonics and only leave you the constant contribution. A way to think about it is that this is this is just a simple generalization of the idea that the integral of a total derivative is zero. So you know that if you do some integral of a function which is sufficiently small at infinity, let me just make it on a circle. So if you have some periodic function, some function defined on a circle, you do an integral like this, you're going to get zero, because this gives you the f, it's 2 pi minus f of zero. So if you have a well-defined function on a circle, it integrates, its derivative integrates to zero. Now, a slight generalization of this is to think about a situation where you have some manifold and some symmetry of the manifold. So this symmetry is implemented by some vector field that tells you how points move along the manifold when you do the symmetry. So if you integrate over a manifold, the variation of a function along this symmetry, and you're integrating over, and everything inside integral is invariant under the symmetry, meaning that you're using a measure of integration of this manifold which is invariant under the symmetry, then this is also going to give you zero. Intuitively, this is just the change of the integral of f of u under the symmetry. But if the integral was symmetric, the function was, if the integral was symmetric, it makes no difference to integrate the function over this, over the same manifold. Okay, the symmetry maps the manifold to itself, doesn't change the measure, doesn't change anything. So instead of changing the function, you can change the manifold, and nothing is going to change. In practice, what you do is you integrate by parts, the same way as here. And if your measure was invariant under the symmetry, this is literally the same as the statement that integration by parts gives you zero. So essentially you can, there is this notion of lead derivative along a vector field that when it acts on functions is just something like that. And it has similar definitions for measures or for forms or whatever other geometric objects. And then you can write roughly this whole thing as this and integrate by parts. Well, it's not very precise. Anyway, so in general, when you have a symmetry and you act on something, you integrate the result over your manifold, you get zero. Okay. So this is true for bosonic symmetries. Today we're going to use intensely the fact that it's still true for a slightly more general kind of type of symmetries, which are fermionic symmetries, Grassmannot symmetries. So suppose that I'm given some integral some bosonic variables, some fermionic variables, some Grassmannot variables. And that I suppose that I have a symmetry which is also Grassmannot. So it sends X to something which is Grassmannot, say and theta to something that is Grassmann even. And particularly, I'm interested in the symmetry which squares to zero. So symmetry of the property that if I act twice on something, I get zero. Then, if it's really a symmetry, so you say that this is a symmetry of this measure, this integral, if it's true that integrating Q of something gives zero. Okay. Now, suppose that I have an integral that looks of a product of functions. And they all satisfy, and they're all annihilated by the symmetry. Okay. Notice that the same way as for bosonic symmetries for the action of a vector field, Q of Fg is F is QF G plus or minus F of QG, depending on G being Grassmannot or Grassmann even, F being Grassmannot or Grassmann even. So when you bring Q across F, you might have to pay a price of a sign. So if I define an integral like this, and I call this the correlation function of these objects, then this integral has a very special property that if any of these is Q of something, then you get zero. Why? Because you can use this rule to essentially rewrite this as Q of the whole thing, because Q kills all the Fs. And then the integral of Q of something is zero. So this sort of integral gives you a map from these observables, from these quantities, to some numbers, which, as long as you restrict yourself to quantities which are symmetric, is invariant if you deform your quantities by exact amounts. More generally, if you deform your whole integral, your integration measure by some action which is Q-exact, this is the same as the integral. So this is T-independent. Let me put a T here. So this is T-independent. So we should just write it like this. The T of this quantity equals zero. So in general, these type of integrals are very robust. You can change the measure of integration in a pretty general way without changing the answer. Okay? So the reason this sort of integrals pop out in gauge fixing is because when you do a gauge fixing, one of the most crucial properties you want to hold is that your final answer does not depend on the gauge fixing. Okay? So when you do a path integral, some quantum field theory which you have gauge fixed in some way, you want to be able to show that the result is independent of how you gauge fixed. But the path integral is going to look pretty different depending on the gauge fixing you do. And you need some mechanism that allows you to make sure that your choice didn't really matter. And this is one way to make that happen. Here we have an integral where we've changed our action in a pretty general way, and the answers do not change. Now, when this is a path integral, this sort of thing is often called topological quantum field theory. Let me just ignore that. So, let me try to give some examples of this formalism. Now, a place where this sort of formalism enters is just when you study differential forms. I don't know if you have you encountered differential forms in previous courses? Can I see a raise of hands for who has seen differential forms? Excellent. Thank you. So let me define a very simple example of this sort of integral. So I'm going to take some x coordinates on some manifold and some fermionic coordinates which sort of carry the same indices, meaning that they live in the tangent of the manifold, although they are fermionic. I guess if you really liked mathematical notation, you would say that this whole thing is the fermionic version of tangent, I don't remember the exact notation, the tangent of the manifold. Anyway, it doesn't matter. And let me just say that Q of x is theta, Q of theta is zero. That's pretty simple. Now, what does it mean concretely if I have a function of x, for example? Well, Q acting on the function of f, you need to take a derivative with respect of x and then replace, pull out an x and replace it with a theta, which concretely means that you do something like theta a dA of f. This is a pretty reasonable operation. Now, the most general function on this funny space can be written as some f of a, b, c, so on. Theta a, theta b, theta c, and so on. So how does Q act on this? Well, when it acts on the theta, it does nothing. When it acts on f, it just acts like that. So I guess it's not like a theta of d. Let me put it. So I'm going to take the derivative of f of a, b, c, theta d, theta a, theta b. Okay. Now notice that these thetas are fermionic variables, so they anti-commute. So this is a totally anti-symmetric expression. So you might want to anti-symmetrize over these indices here. Now, you should be able to identify these with the differential acts on differential forms. If you just blink and instead of theta, you read dx, this is just the action of a differential over a differential form. I just gave a funny name to the dx's. Now, how would an integral look like? Notice that now I can write product of dx d theta, and this makes a lot of sense. Because if you do a coordinate transformation, the dx is transformed by the Jacobian. The thetas live in the tangent, so they transform by the Jacobian in the opposite way. If you remember how things work for the Grassmann variables, the measure of a Grassmann integral transforms in the opposite way. The measure of a bosonic integral. These guys have indices on the same place. So the transformation produces the opposite determinant of the Jacobian. They completely cancel out. So here I don't need a measure. I don't need a metric to put a square root of g or whatever. I just write dx d theta, and that makes sense. Now, for the integral to be non-zero, I need to have as many thetas as d thetas. So the simplest thing I can integrate is something that corresponds to the top form. So f1, 2, 3, all the way to the dimension of the space, theta 1, all the way to theta d. And then this cancels out. And I'm left with the integral of this top form or the manifold. So now you can recognize what these sort of expressions are. Here, I'm just taking a bunch of forms, taking the wedge product, and integrating them over the manifold. The result, as you know, if the forms are closed, the result does not depend by shifting the forms by an exact amount. Any questions? Okay, this is a rather simple example. Now, let me look at a slightly different example. Suppose now I have a group, a Lie group. Okay, so it's a manifold, which is also a group. So I have the coordinates on the on G, which I could write perhaps. Well, so I want to write a simple generalization of this. Now, if I have a group, the group acts on itself. So there are vector fields that correspond to the action of the group over itself. These are called the Lie derivative. I mean, so the so there are some vector fields that are labeled by elements in the Lie algebra. And if you take the bracket of these vector fields, you get the structure constants of your Lie algebra. Have you seen anything like that before? Is it reasonably familiar? Okay. Now let me try to define a funny symmetry. If I have a function over the group, so I'm going to take my group and I'm going to add a bunch of fermions, which again have the same indices as this as the that live in the Lie algebra of the group. Then just modifying this expression slightly to something like this. Actually, let me call change name of these fermions. Let me call them CAs. Not to confuse. So when I want to act on a function, I do an essentially this act as an infinitesimal group transformation, whose parameters are the fermions. Okay? So it's literally, it's infinitesimal in a very literal sense that C squared is zero. These are fermions. Okay, think about this as a fermionic partner of a group transformation. Yes. So this is the yeah, here. So this is just the, I mean, in this part, it is a function. This just really literally means CA, I should probably put the index down, sorry. VA ID over AGI. So what is this sum? Just some local coordinates on your manifold, and this is the vector field. Okay. Now, here, the symmetry was obviously nilpotent. If I act twice on a function, I just get theta A, theta B, dA, dB. dA, dB is symmetric. Theta A, theta B is anti-symmetric, it drops out. Here, not so much. What happens if I do Q squared of F of G? So I might be acting on the Cs. I still didn't tell you how this works. Or I could act on this bosonic part. There's a minus here. Okay. Now this is not zero now, because CACB is anti-symmetric, LALB is not symmetric. Just by the definition of this bracket, LALB is F. putting the indices, I keep putting the indices at the wrong place, sorry. Okay. So this is the same as FABC LC. Not zero, but I can cancel it if I define my Q properly on C. So if I define Q CA as F of A B C C B C C, then this term cancels this term, and I get zero. Now I still need to check that this transformation makes sense. I can compute Q square of C. I get something like F A B C F B E F C C C E C F. Okay. This is totally anti-symmetric, so I can anti-symmetrize here. And this is zero by the Jacobi identities. Another way to think about this, actually, let me just finish. There's a 1/2 here that is pretty important. See, this is the same as 1/2 times CAB times the commutator. So I need a 1/2 here. Okay. So this is another funny symmetry. And you can do integrals over your group. Of functions that satisfy these properties. Mm-hmm. Mm? Yes. This is some. So, right, we want to measure which is invariant under these transformations, because this the way the transformation acts on bosonic variables is just a Fermilic version of the group transformation. If I have a measure which is invariant under the group transformations, it could be invariant under these two. But at this point, this is not terribly interesting, meaning the things you end up integrating here are not very familiar to you, presumably. So there are some functions of the group times with some indices in the Lie algebra. This is some sort of funny cohomology theory over your group. Now, still, this is an ingredient of a lot of constructions. So it's a crucial ingredient for our BST symmetry. It's also an important ingredient for something called equivariant cohomology, which is essentially a situation where you have a manifold with a group action on it, and you want to study the quotient of the manifold by the group action, the space of orbits. And you can define, morally speaking, you want to define a cohomology on that quotient. And a nice way to do it is to study something called the equivariant cohomology of the original space. So it's essentially, not something I need to get into it because it's not precisely BST symmetry, but it's an interesting physical way to think about the equivalent cohomology. Now, instead, I'm going to improve this just a little bit. See, what's not nice about this is that I need to have a lot of C's here. So I cannot do things like just integrate functions over your manifold. But okay. Now let me define just one third example, and we'll be ready. So an example where I have four variables, X, C, B, and capital B. So now Q of X is C, Q of C is 0. So this is the same as we encountered before. And instead, B and C behave kind of in the opposite way. So these are fermionic, and these are bosonic. So this time it's Q, the fermionic guy, that gives me the bosonic guy. So it's like we're doubling up things even farther. We start here, we start with an X, we introduce some fermion, which was parallel to X. And now we introduce yet another fermion and a boson for it. So let's see, let me just consider a very simple integral. So I want to put Q of something here. And the something I'll pick is some function of X times B. So let me expand this out. And if, now we can evaluate this integral in a straightforward way. The integral over capital B just gives me a delta function. The integral over BC just pulls down this factor. Now, this is definitely an integral we can do. So you can do it in two different ways. One, we can just change coordinates from X to F. And the other is we can just use the delta function to pick all the values where F of X is 0. Let me do it the latter way. So I get the sum over all the points where F of X is 0. Of, so you might remember that the integral of a delta of f involves a sum over the zeros of f, and the answer involves a 1 over absolute value of the first derivative of f. Times whatever else was there in the integral. Now this is quite a fun expression. We're taking the first derivative and dividing it by the absolute value of the first derivative. So it's just a sum over signs, over the sign. Okay. So let me draw a picture. Okay. Suppose my f was something that does like this. Okay. Then it intersects the f equal to 0 axis only at one point with a positive slope. So my integral would be 1. Now suppose that my f is a little bit more, a little bit wilder. Now it intersects in 3 points, but with sine 1, minus 1, 1. So the answer is still 1. So as long as my function is negative in the pi on the left and positive on the right, far on the right, I get 1. If my function instead is positive and then negative and positive, I'm going to get 0. So that means the answer of this integral, it's constant, depends on f very, very weakly. As long as you don't mess up with the behavior at infinity of f, the integral does not depend on the specific shape of f. Okay? And the way to understand that is that if I want to change f, I can just send f to f plus delta f. But I will be changing the action by something q exact. So nothing should change. Don't leave it. Mm-hmm.
So is there, I don't know if it would be possible to see this, but is there some way of seeing what exactly the implication of this charge is in this geometric picture? Like, what is it telling us about the shape?
It tells you how many times the graph.
Right.
Well, there is, that it gives you the intersection number of the graph of f with the real axis. Now, notice that when you really try to check why q of f in certain integral, q of delta f in certain integral gives you 0, you encounter some integration by parts. So q exact things, they couple only if they have a reasonable behavior at infinity. And we saw it here. If you change f by an amount that just pulls the whole left hand side up, that can definitely change. So if you change the behavior at infinity of f, the answer can change. But as long as your changes are reasonable, the answer will remain the same. Okay, so why is this interesting? Well, see, this is when you start the elasticity symmetry, this is going to be the analog of a gauge fixing condition. Yeah. You impose some constraint in your integral, f equal to 0. I want to integrate just on the space of f equal to 0, which here is just points. But to do it in a meaningful way, you need to insert some Jacobian to make sure that the delta function integrates to something specific. So for example, if you have some manifold with some group action, the action of some gauge group, you want to make sure that you integrate over all possible representatives of the all possible orbits of this gauge group action. As I was saying yesterday, you want to make sure that you divide by the volume of the orbits in a consistent way. So orbits are just images of your group, of your gauge group. The size of these images, so that essentially you can think about it as a rescaled version of your gauge group. So the amount they are scaled by, you can read it just by a little neighborhood of the place where you're integrating. So if you want to do the integral over the gauge orbit, you can do the integral over everything, but dividing by the volume of the orbits. And they can be done just by dividing by a little Jacobian that tells you how much this orbit has been blown up compared to other orbits. So now let me be a bit more concrete. So I can modify this in two different ways. I can extend to a general group, or I can extend it in such a way that instead of canceling everything out and just getting a number, I only cancel the orbit of some group inside some bigger manifold. So let me do both. So the first situation is where I have some manifold with a natural one-dimensional group. It could be R, it could be S1, let's say it's R. So I have some vector field, essentially, on my manifold. This vector field has orbits, and I want to somehow only integrate over the orbits of this vector field instead of integrating over the whole manifold. Now, there is a very simple variant of this theory. Now I can say that Q of X is a fermionic version of the action of this vector field.
When you say orbits of a vector field,
yes.
Do you mean the foliation of the distribution?
I'm not being infinitely precise here. Yes, I imagine this vector field comes from some reasonable group action, from some action of R or from S1. So that when you integrate the trajectories of the vector space, you get a bunch of lines in your manifold. Yeah. And you want to integrate over these lines, over the space of these lines. Or if you want, you want to just count one point for each line. So this is exactly what I did here. But in a sense, I embed this direction X. Actually, let me just call this the coordinates on the manifold Y. Okay. I sort of embedded this X direction inside my manifold. So more or less speaking, there is this big space parameterized by the Ys, and along each orbit I'm parameterizing by X. So up here I added this C, B, and D, B and capital B, as a way to sort of cancel out, make X very topological, make the integrals of X into something topological, which would be one situation. Here I'm adding the same C, B, and D to make a part of this manifold topological, to make part of this integration predetermined. So now I can consider the same setup. I can integrate some functions over the manifold, say, and then add this sort of action. And the result should not depend very much on the specific choice of little f, as long as this function is Q closed, which essentially means it's killed by the vector field. It's a function, it's a gauge invariant function. So I'm trying to define the integral of gauge invariant functions with some specific gauge fixing. Now, just by doing integral over B, you see that this is really gauge fixing. Meaning, as long as my function is non-trivial over the orbits, this is going to cut a locus f equal to 0. And then integral over B and C, or little b and little c, gives me the Jacobian. Which tells me how much these orbits are blown up compared to the group itself. So the group is parameterized by X and I could explain this better, but I've been slower than I hoped. Okay. So usually when you study VST symmetry, say in QED, you go backwards. First you argue geometrically that this is the proper gauge fixed integral. That if you want to integrate a gauge invariant quantity, without overcounting, you need to introduce some delta function to cut down the overcounting and introduce a Jacobian to make sure that this is to account for the size of the gauge orbits. And then you rewrite it like this, and you observe that this has this symmetry. Now, yes. Yes. That's right. So now from this point of view, introducing this B, C, and capital B looks like a gimmick. I could have just worked like this. Now in a quantum field theory, inserting this sort of things is inconvenient, while it's much easier to just have an action with these extra fields. But there are a lot of situations where having these ghosts and having the symmetry help out figuring out the proper way to write the answers. Now, first of all, as I was saying, the symmetry makes it obvious why changing gauge fixing will not change the answer, even in the infinitesimal, or at least gives you tools to prove in the quantum field theory situation the different gauge fixings are equivalent. Now, it also helps dealing with situations where the gauge fixing is not as good as you would have liked. So sometimes you end up with gauge fixing which in 2 minutes. First, I wanted to. So here it was just an abelian group. I just wanted to mention the generalization to a non-abelian group. So you can take these transformation rules as they are and just add. Let me just revise them. So I can say that Q of f of y is C A times the action of the group on the function. Q C A is f of A, B, C, C, B, C, C. And then I can add some little b's and big b's. Okay. Notice that, so here there is no need to have a precise correspondence in the number of c's and number of b's. Okay. I stress that out by putting a different index on the b's. So when you do your, so you can do the same thing as we did here. So you get integrals which look like integral sum gauge invariant quantities. So this index really lives in the space of gauge fixing conditions. So you want to put one pair of B, little b, capital B, for every gauge fixing condition you want. One C for every group symmetry. And then you get integrals like this, where the capital B is implement the gauge fixing conditions. And little b, little c's give you the Jacobian for these gauge fixing conditions. So this is a standard form of the gauge fixed path integral. Now, sometimes people just integrate away capital B right away. So if your gauge fixing is good enough, you can just use it to remove the group symmetries. So implement the delta functions concretely in your integral. Then you can do it by integrating away B. We integrate capital B, essentially you replace it by its equations of motion. Well, I'll come back to this because there's no more time, but when you do that, essentially what happens is that capital B gets replaced by the equation of motions for the modes that you have gauge fixed. Now, as I was saying, you don't necessarily need the number of b's, the number of c's to match perfectly. So in string theory, as you remember, I told you that the space of matrix, modulo diffeomorphisms, and wild transformations is in one-to-one correspondence to the modular space of complex structures. So that means you when you add the Planck integral, you don't want to get rid of the matrix completely. You expect to be left with at the end with an integral of the modular space of complex structures. So a way to think about this is that you had some gauge fixing condition. The gauge fixing was, say, trying to fix the metric in terms of something. But you cannot just fix it to something flat. Right? Instead, what you can do is to pick a family of reference metrics for these complex structures. So a family of reference metrics labeled by the complex structures. And integrate over the complex structures. So instead of just inserting a delta function or some gauge fixing condition, you have a situation where you sort of want to insert the integral of some delta function. Now, a way to deal with this is just by enriching the structure a little bit by including these variables and including some partners for them. So you could say that you include some the m's, and qm is some sigma. So now when you, so if you do your path integral over dm, the sigma, dB, dC, the capital B, dy. Because q squared to zero, you know that everything is going to be fine. Topological and all of that. But now, if you start with an action f of y and m, if your gauge fixing looks like this, right? This, then you get an extra term in the action. So you get this stuff plus the action of Q on M. So something like sigma dm df over dm times little b. Okay. Now you can just do the path integral over the sigmas. You pull this down from the integral. Let's get the sort of determinant, the product of these guys, one for each sigma. So you see that in these situations, the integral of the, in a sense, the BST formalism is producing for us the correct measure to integrate over the modular space of complex structure, or the modular space of these gauge fixing conditions. And it does it by a bunch of B insertions. So you see, so this is a situation essentially where we had a gauge fixing condition which was too strict. And we needed to relax it by integrating over part of the parameters. So if the gauge condition was too strict, it means that you had more gauge fixing conditions than group, than symmetries. So you had more B's than C's. Now if you have more B's than C's, this integral is going to give you some trouble because B's and C's are always in pairs. So after you do the integral, you're left with more B's than C's. More the B's than the C's, you would get zero. But these extra B's compensate for that. So this is not something that you encountered in quantum electrodynamics, but it's something we're encountering in string theory. In string theory, the numbers of B's and C's are a little bit mismatched. And sometimes your gauge fixing condition, right, risks being a little bit too strong. Sometimes it risks being a little bit too weak. And you have some symmetries which are not completely fixed. So if you're, whenever your condition is too strict, you get an integral over the, an extra integral with some B insertions. Whenever your condition is not strict enough, there is another mechanism that produces some C insertions, so that the final answer still makes sense. Okay. Any questions? Well, in principle, yes. So the question that one always has to ask when applying this formalism is, are Q exact things really decoupling? So is it really true that Q of something exact is zero? And for a compact group, it's very easy to show. For a non-compact group, there can be subtleties. If you're taking Q of something which is not behaving well enough at infinity. In quantum field theory or in string theories, these things can in principle happen. So there are a variety of, you need to sort of check at every step of the, every time you compute something, that your Q exact things are truly decoupling from the calculation. If they don't, it means that there was some problem. It could have been a problem with how you did the gauge fixing. It could have been a more intrinsic problem, some anomaly, something really sick in the theory you're trying to define. So in string theory, typically this lack of decoupling of two exact things occasionally happens, and usually for very good physical reasons. So it's telling you, I don't know, if you're doing a calculation and you're not taking into account some infrared effects, the Q will Q exact will not decouple, or things like that. So it can happen if your theory is well defined. It should only happen for good reasons. So it means that you're asking a question which was wrong.
So how does this formalism talk to anomalies?
Well, it means if there was an anomaly, it just means that Q squared is not zero.
Okay.
Very directly. And that it precisely happens in string theory with the wild anomaly, with the dimension equal to 26. We define Q, we compute Q squared, and Q squared is going to have a piece that is D minus 26 times. Sorry, I'm not sure this year I improved over last year. They were both pretty confused presentations. But you can look at last year for extra.